Helm, set a course.
Headed.
Engage.
Let's fly.
Welcome, one and all, to Discovery, a Star Trek podcast by Fantastic Geek, your official, unofficial Star Trek podcast. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hailing frequencies are open.
I can't hear you. I'm too far ahead. Discovery, a Star Trek podcast by Fantastic Geek, for episode 506, Whistle Speak, comes to you now via distilled water.
And news from the fleet before this episode leaves orbit. Pete, counting down to Marvel Studios' Deadpool and Wolverine. Pete, not only is there news about, you know, cameos, casting, I saw a video this morning positing, Pete, I won't say who, but positing that the footage of Wolverine in the white tuxedo jacket might not be Hugh Jackman.
Oh, that's old. That is as old as that trailer is from like a month or two ago. Giancarlo Esposito took to social media Friday to say he's been cast in the MCU. He says it's not who you think it is. A lot of people led to believe that it's a role in Fantastic Four.
Look, that would be fun. I've said it before and I'll say it again. The solution to all the MCU's woes, at least short term, I'm not saying get rid of everything that's still on the board, but, you know, has already been, you know, appeared on screen and whatnot. But the solution is X-Men, Fantastic Four, and Deadpool. And Pete, what do they have coming? Deadpool plus an X-Man, perhaps multiple X-Men this summer, Fantastic Four the following summer. Everything's going to be okay. Pete, as we record this on May the 5th or whatever the thing is, the
Revenge of the 5th.
Revenge of the 5th. Yesterday, Pete, I only observed the one day. I know there's a whole thing. Somebody who we follow on Instagram has a whole thing spelled out how it's like the 6th is George Lucas's birthday and the 18th is the whatever, the Attack of the Clones anniversary or whatever.
I believe it's now just this is the May.
I know this, Pete. Yesterday was May the 4th and we were talking Star Wars. I got to check in with all the latest info on the Acolyte series. Looking forward to that coming out in now less than 1 month's time.
Yes, a scene placed at the end of the episode one re-release for the 25th anniversary out this weekend. Then also a new trailer and the poster revealed. So yeah, we are officially inside of a month. Get yourself over to Apple Podcasts. Subscribe now to the Acolyte Podcast by Fantastic Geek. Give us a rating. Give us a review. The next Fantastic Geek adventure.
And in fact, Pete, I could be off on the math here. And of course, we always do season previews and season wraps. And, you know, for Discovery, we'll do a season wrap and a series wrap and all that. But just in terms of episodic presentations, there's this entire Discovery run that finishes 1 week. The next week is when Acolyte starts. There then is the whole 7 week Acolyte run, 8 episodes total, 2 of the first week. That wraps up, I think, something like Tuesday, June 16th, something like that. The next week is Wolverine and Deadpool. Pardon me. July 16th and July 23rd, 4th, 5th, somewhere in there is when Deadpool and Wolverine comes out. Pete, it's moments like this where it feels like the podcast gods are giving us a favorable wind, where it's just literally a new story a week from the beginning of Discovery through Deadpool and Wolverine. I'll take it.
It's all connected.
Pete, from that highest high to the lowest lows or continuing lows here, we got an email from Dustin, who was giving us a quick update and some numbers. And indeed, Pete, an article from the Wall Street Journal about the woes of Paramount Global. Let me take you through Dustin's words here. He had some context, some more details and so forth. As of right now, Pete, as we record, rumor is that Paramount is souring on the idea of Skydance buying the whole thing. Dustin points out that the Apollo/Sony bid, while it values the company at $26 billion, part of that $26 billion is the assumption of $14 billion of debt. So if nothing else, when I saw Dustin's email and read the article he shared, it was like, oh, the numbers aren't as far apart as we thought. you know, Apollo Sony saying, we value your company at $12 billion versus Skydance at about six. In the last week, the CEO, Bob Bakish, stepped down. And as Dustin points out, I will quote him here. I personally appreciate in the article the extra context that Shari Redstone, head of all this, has competing priorities, what with her Turks and Caicos mansion under construction. So Pete, Nero fiddles while Paramount burns.
So they made a big deal that Alex Kurtzman was going to be on the Ready Room this week. And I know just the nature of the business, those had to be filmed ahead of time. It seemed like it was around the time that Picard was still coming out. So this was done sometime spring of last year. And he mentions Section 31, and he mentions what they're calling Starfleet, as in Starfleet Academy, but reveals nothing. And Matt, then we got an email. What was that, Thursday?
We got an email Thursday. We'll dive into that later on in the podcast. But just,
and it's not from Alex Kurtzman. I just want to be clear.
Oh, yeah.
It's not from him, but it's super telling in terms of Paramount and its influence and really mismanagement of Star Trek.
Pete, we'll dig into that later. For now, let's head into this week's mission briefing.
Stamets examines the vial of liquid from the piece of the progenitor's puzzle they found on the ISS Enterprise, asking if the scientists designed the clues just to mock them when they can't solve them. Burnham recaps they've been trying to figure it out for 2 days. Stamets says they've run 100 other tests on it. The vial's composition is generic. The water is pure, inert, distilled, and wet. Burnham points out the vial is damaged and that perhaps it's missing a piece. Tilly says modified spectral analysis reveals the fluid is still just distilled water. Stamets turns on the lights to reveal they are in engineering and explains he even scanned the Enterprise to make sure they didn't miss anything. Burnham says if chemistry isn't the answer, they should try history or anthropology, like planets where distilled water had cultural or symbolic significance 800 years ago, including worlds that had severe droughts and would have needed rainwater alternatives.
Pete, can I point out that earlier in the scene when they are doing this analysis, it's done entirely by shining colorful lights into the eyes of the actors. Pete, that's because this is an economical production. Please don't take Star Trek away, they're saying to future owners. But this notion here, let's view all of this through the lens of chemistry, history, anthropology, climatology, and so forth. That does spark a thought in the team, and Burnham beams out and into Kovich's white room. Also, Pete, a very economical set. He does not have an update. However, he is spreading the work around. He notes that pieces of the trail are secret. And let's not forget that each part of the individual scientists' backgrounds are unknown, and each individual scientist contributed to this puzzle piece, perhaps not in concert with the other. He's got a list. Pete, it's on a yellow legal pad from the economical legal pads of the 21st century, and he encourages her to get to work. We cut to Culber on what initially appears to be the holophone, indeed just a true holographic representation of his abuela, talking about the Mofongo. Her's secret, Pete, is that it's actually replicated. It's at this point, it's revealed she's a holo. The program is paused. This is ultimately a grief reflection program, something to help deal with your emotions.
Yes, sending Pollard an email. They might be onto something here. He's impressed by the brainwave patterning, and the holo is exactly as he remembers his grandmother. He restarts it and talks to her about his experience on Trill. And when she says she can't help him understand it, Culber asks the computer to check the database because she should be able to answer that, as they often spoke about her spiritual feelings and practices. the holograph says that while that's true, how can they consider the soul when they have not examined the body?
Back to Burnham. We're all going to Denoblia to get more information on Dr. Creel, or rather, Stamets has some weather info about cloud seeding and contaminants and all of that. They decide to check Denoblian trade routes, particularly through the lens of arid planets. They find Halemno. So let's Halem go to it. They have a rain tower designed by Dr. Creel. It looks like a mountain. The people there are pre-warp and pre-industrial. All of this is reported by a halting Adira. First day on the bridge for them. Time to get ready for a mission on foot. And we have to preserve the Prime Directive. Our team headed down to the surface. Burnham and Tilly on the go. We get the credits. This episode written by Kenneth Lynn and Brandon Schultz and directed by Chris Byrne.
Tilly meets Burnham as she listens to the whistling of the Halemnites' language. And Zora translates. They don't always speak in whistles, but it allows them to communicate over great distances. There are no terms in their language to denote societal status or class. They recognize three distinct gender identities and prize connection despite tremendous hardships faced. They have multiple words for pain, injury, hurt, and dust, making Burnham feel like she's back in Dr. Taprazi's xenolinguistics class on Vulcan. Tilly says, they could really use her at Starfleet Academy when it starts filming. But Burnham says not to tempt her. Of course, I'm adding the starting filming thing there as an editorialization, but we'll talk more about that in a little bit, Matt, for a special guest episode. As Burnham asks Tilly how it's going there, Rainer interrupts that they've loaded subcutaneous comms into the transporter, and Adira has been playing with Starfleet's latest retinal tricorder. Burnham has Rainer beam them down, where they materialize in the shadow of the tower. The Halemnites call the High Summit and activate their, it looks like the, what are those, the heterochromatic tricorders, because they each have one eye that's a different color.
Yeah, which was an interesting, like, this is a film and TV thing that in order for us to know that the thing that logically could be done without us seeing it, of course, we need to see it because it's film and TV and so forth. Like, I totally get it, and that's probably a cheaper
route. So fair is fair, then. If we're going to ding them, you know, every point they get to try to show that they're saving money, like, to go through and create whether it was an actual contact or whether they did that digitally, like, you got to give them credit.
Yeah. And also, too, I mean, I'm reminded all the way back to, you know, the early genesis of the original Star Trek series, you know, Gene Roddenberry's thing. In a police show, they don't explain how a gun works. They show you, bang, bang, somebody fell over there. That's how a gun works, right? Same thing. You don't need to weigh us down with, oh, there's this brand new thing, regardless of its genesis, financial or otherwise. Oh, we understand it. There's eyeball science on the eyeball. Got it. Tilly reflects on Cadet Ross, who's unsure about staying on at the academy. Pete, maybe.
Many are.
The cadets aren't getting what they need. And just as we're whetting our beaks with that, Pete, we hear whistle speak. Hello, travelers. Escape the dust and take refuge. Pete, this is a very Star Trek notion here, that of the whistle speak.
I appreciated that not only are you giving a language the sounds, and all right, you can translate that however, but that it came through in rhymes, the sing-songy nature. I don't know. I thought it was a cool flourish. Aboard Discovery, Book finds Culber on his way to engineering. Book asks if Culber can put him in touch with the USS Lockerer's counselor so he can give them a full background on Maul and Locke. But Culber's sure they've been briefed. But Book says, no, that's not the same. Culber tells Book he has to accept there's nothing he can do right now. But Book tells him he can't just sit on his hands. Culber suggests he finds a distraction to recharge himself for when he is needed.
Indeed, they're going to do that neural scan, get the info on the Trill body swap. They're going to do it tomorrow, which is a handy way, Pete, of wrapping up this scene, which lets the editor take us back to the planet where our heroes meet the Dusty Travelers and are asked to join on in on the group. The primary traveling lady here was in the drylands for so long, breathing dust for the entire night as she coughs. She cleared the dust so that others would not need to. As for the high summit, Burnham and Tilly have traveled far. Pete, this is a lowercase c classic Star Trek case of we are not from here. We are from very far and thus shall not give more information. And you who are not as from as far shall not ask for more. But they also do confirm no one goes into the high summit structure, right? The high summit mountain, right? Nobody goes in. Rava sees them, invites all in. They look for the traveling lady's medicine. But of course, Tilly and Burnham cannot overly help. Even as her back is patted, Pete, is there any local solution for what ails her?
Well, Rava's father, or Vaz here, says that that Burnham should continue doing that because she's keeping her alive. And then the singing bowls are brought out here. The clanging on them creates an effect that Burnham begins to notice, and the dust clears from the woman's mouth before she herself blacks out.
Later, Burnham wakes up next to the woman. The father, Ovaz, couldn't warn her about the sound cure, which is a handy way of saying, I know the writers needed an act end and thus got it. Off screen, Tilly has gotten more information about the high summit. Dad and daughter, that's Ovaz and Rava, are of split decisions as to whether one should enter the summit. But this much is clear, the race, known as the Journey of the Mother Compeer, only the worthy may enter, you know, having won the race and all of that. Pete, I bet you it's Burnham. That's what my notes say. Good job, episode. I was sure that Burnham would be the complete and total star of this foot race, etc. Not the case. I doff my cap to thee, particularly since in prior episodes I've been a little critical of the show, not spreading around the story love as much as they could. Here they do. Good job.
Within the defeat of expectations, you've also got the usual within Star Trek, right? You've got the Prime Directive story, and in that you've got the naive Rava, who's giving away way too much information, and the slightly more reserved dad, who's like, I really wish you wouldn't tell them all our ways. And this is how Burnham learns, hey, all I have to do is make the request to win the race. I'm totally gonna win, right? Okay. But the next day, Rava has been inspired by Burnham and Tilly, as have others, and they will all run the race, which most don't finish. Ovaz asks for a word with Rava about undertaking the journey at such a young age. He notices Rava has a wristband of his late wife's. Ovaz is pulled away to make preparations for the journey. Tilly tells Rava she has a student that is also anxious to do things. Tilly says it's hard to step back as a teacher and can only imagine what it's like as a parent. But Rava wants to show dad greatness just like his. Burnham butts in, and she and Tilly talk quickly with Discovery to learn Adira did an historical regression of Halemno's weather patterns, and data indicates that there may have been other towers. Raynor sent says that they sent dots down and found four other towers. But Adira notes they failed over time. Their energy distribution matrices falling out of alignment, which is also happening to the high summit. That's why they can't beam inside right now. So Raynor says the towers have an auxiliary control panel hidden nearby, and they should be able to reset the components. Tilly asks if there were settlements around the other towers and learns there were, and now that those are wiped out, raising the stakes for these people here.
We go back to sick bay where the scan has concluded. Culber is A-okay. There's, at least in terms of the scan, there's no lasting effects. There's no Cylon chip making him see people that aren't there. Nothing. But still, he feels different. He feels the opposite of sick. Pete, somebody needs to write like a Malcolm Gladwell-esque book called The Opposite of Sick, colon, and then whatever the subtitle would be, you know, like holistic eating with extra lettuce or yoga and how to improve the soul, something like that. The Opposite of Sick. That's a book. You could see the author of The Opposite of Sick going on Stephen Colbert and, you know, having a good old interview. Culber indeed feeling more connected and attuned to something bigger than himself. Stamets suggests that it be simply enjoyed. Back to the planet. Who's ready to run the race? The traveling woman says to take caution, and the start of the race is blessed. It's noted that in ancient times, the dust was sent to punish. Oh, take one of these snacks. It is but a single chip ahead of your challenge, a sort of one chip challenge, if you will. And as everyone takes it, their lungs fill with the cough. They are tasked with bearing the terrible thirst here. You must earn the rain. And if you drink from these liberally distributed bowls, then you lose and go.
Yeah, the cubes they put in here, I like your invocation of that other thing that has since been removed from stores because a boy died, not poisoned by it, but the ridiculous spice that was on those and everything that was caused there. I'm pretty sure they wrote this before that happened, though.
This could have been written 2 years ago at the height of the one chip challenge.
There are people that do dumb things with their bodies. The biggest rule I live by is you should never use your digestive tract as a funhouse.
Pete, as these runners run, they pass the water stops. However, it's Burnham who requires a moment here. And Pete, it is in that pause. I don't know if this is a finger wag, Pete. I feel like this could have been an opportunity to be like, hey, Discovery, beam down an inhaler or something. Instead, though, because Burnham has paused, she sees mutated moss. All the rest is green, for this is yellow, indicative of radiation. Perhaps the control panel is that way. One of them needs to run. One needs to go to the control panel. Burnham shall go the control panel way, and Tilly shall continue to run.
Burnham hits a bowl, as do others here. When Tilly twists like she might drop, Rava rescues her, and it's just the two of them remaining. Burnham follows that yellow moss to a rock and uses her retinal tricorder to see the panel inside. She scans it, and Adira says it requires periodic maintenance and was bound to fail. Burnham needs to rebuild the motherboard without shutting it down by accident, so Adira walks her through that. As Tilly and Rava reach the end, Ovaz stops them to explain the mother, Compeer, was tempted to drink near the end, so they must now each carry a bowl. Rava falls and spills it, though. Tilly turns back and pours half of her bowl into Rava's, and they cross the finish line together. Burnham rearranges the isolinear chips, and Adira asks Raynor if they should get someone with more experience to help the captain, but he says he wouldn't have suggested them if he didn't think they were ready, and notes how they've been second-guessing themselves since the time bug. Adira has Burnham bypass the auxiliary power circuit, and it resets. Burnham lets Tilly know how they solved the interference issue, and Tilly recaps that she and Rava tied, and they're now in the temple, not a clue in sight.
Rava tells Ovaz that they will bring the rain, and he's impressed by the sacrifice of Rava. Wait, sacrifice? The tension just changed here. Also, Tilly cannot be beamed out on account of the tritanium that is present there. The rocks start to shift, indeed closing them off. Simultaneously on Discovery, the signal is scrambled. But Pete, not so scrambled that they don't have comms, because it's a TV show where they need to continue to radio each other to keep like dialogue happening. Tilly and Rava are in a vacuum chamber. All of this, again, made possible by the tritanium. The ladies will die, however, the air slowly leaving. Kudos to the production here using the flames, the candle light that's present, and it's slowly going out as this portion of the story continues. Burnham says that she will help beam me into the control room. Just do it. Highly a prime directive violation. But if they don't fix the tech, everyone will die soon enough, which, Pete, I'll just point out, technically speaking, the prime directive does not care that everyone will die. It's also like 1,000 years of prime directive violations. So I'm not being critical of the show. I'm just saying they're strictly playing by the prime directive in an organization that has, 800-900 years of fooling around the prime directive.
Right. And everybody, I think, understands that it's the solves in Star Trek where they don't break it that really wind up surprising you. Right. Again, subversion of expectation. They will have to answer for it, and we'll have to see if that impacts them as the story moves on. But Burnham notes the Helem Knights can't maintain the tech, and they'll have to learn of the technology sooner or later. So Prime Directive, I like how they bake that into the story. Like, whether you tell them now, you tell them later, we're going to have to get at them to save this species. So Raynor relents. Rava shows Tilly the ancient Helemnes numbers, revealing they are in the third summit. Tilly has seen the fifth symbol before, representing all the towers. Rava breaks down and cries, not wanting to die, regretting that they wanted to make Ovaz proud. As he prays in the control room nearby, Burnham beams in and explains they're actually in a machine. He writes her off as the god's temptation, and Tilly and Rava are running out of air. Tilly gets Rava to teach her a song Mom used to hum, which Burnham repeats and explains she can do that because she can hear Tilly and Rava through technology as well. Burnham convinces Ovaz to pull a handle from under a rug that opens the door where they are not breathing. Culber beams in with another, and they work to save them.
I also, Pete, on first view, want to note that my expectations were subverted. I was sure that Rava's song and the musical intervals and the math and the numbers on the wall, it was going to be some sort of, play the song on the oldie organ a la Goonies. I know Stranger Worlds also did that, something like that in the first season, but I was expecting it to be that. I also want to note, the one spot where the secret pulley is to open the door, it's underneath the little sacred scrap of carpet. Again, not a story foul. I'm just having fun with the story here. After this act break of Rava not breathing, Ovaz is looking at an image of his planet. Rava also has been saved. The story of the Savin Denobulians is recounted as they simply wanted to help. Burnham and company will show how to maintain the tower. Does this mean there are no gods? Burnham says that none of this disproves God, but this story now rather moves alongside it. The open-minded will accept the science, and denying it can cause almost as much chaos as the worst storm. Pete, I think that's our lesson for the day.
Yeah, and the woman they had met at the beginning, whose name was Enora, they reveal here, she told Burnham that she didn't think the sacrifices were necessary, right? Because her friend who won the race was sacrificed and never seen again. So it was there all along. And I think with the hindsight of the end of the story being really eloquent, that that's come to pass here. Culber comes over and says that Rava will awake soon, and they should see their father when they do, given the circumstances. Ovaz replaces the wristband on Rava, and Tilly shows Burnham the symbols on the Serenity Wall. So the clue is in Tower 5. Rava awakens in the arms of a proud Papa, and the rains return. Matt, take us to Book in the Shuttle playing a 32nd century virtual boy.
Indeed, he's playing his shooting game. You know, Pete, it's great for Star Trek to represent people like you and me, middle-aged guys still playing video games occasionally, especially when life is tough. You say, you know what, I will go commit Grand Theft Auto, or I will go save the princess from another castle, and so forth.
I, too, am a member of a Splatoon.
But while playing this shooting game in a pre-existing set, Culber has brought Mafungo. It's replicated. Culber doesn't always have all the answers, despite and amidst this spiritual awakening. Book has seen this sort of situation in Burnham, despite her once being used to solace. Book misses what he had with Burnham. Perhaps there will be more, one answer at a time, they say, towards the end of the first episode of the second half of the season. We go to engineering, where they've gotten, indeed, that next piece, courtesy of an off-screen Tower 5 adventure, which I'm slightly finger-waggy towards, but also I appreciate that they've stopped and said, for these different clues, how are we going to do different but the same clues each week? And the fact that it wasn't like, you got to the top of the tower, here's the map. I appreciate that it was like, no, actually go somewhere else where it's just sitting there, you know, or whatever that story conceit is. I know this, Pete. There's a Beta Z tag that needs to be analyzed. And when that is finally found, probably in the first 5 minutes of next week's episode, they're going to continue on. But they, of course, need to be oh so careful.
Yes, the lesson here, the dangers of and the massive responsibility of technology, which seems to mirror the care they'll need to take with the progenitor's power of creation. But it's at this point, because moments are ticking down at the end of this file, Matt, Lieutenant Christopher interrupts Burnham and Tilly to tell them they just got a message from Matt's Fed HQ. They said it. They said the thing that the lockerer found Maul and Locke off screen. Also off screen, Admiral Vance has requested they jump there immediately. And Discovery jumps away from the whistling world.
Pete, we have a tactical analysis of this week's threats. Let's start with the threat of doubt.
Adira, Ovaz, even Culber, all dealing with this throughout the episode. Adira still struggling. Did I bring the time bug on board? Is this all because of me? Should I even be on the bridge and helping out here? But Rayner showing the faith with Culber, the the spiritual angle that we pursued for a couple episodes now, and the solve there from Stamets. Just go with it and enjoy it, because you may not always have it. And then with Ovaz, the idea of, okay, is what I have always believed not really possible?
Yeah, it's nice to see an episode that has kind of this one theme, and there's obviously some other topics to discuss, but this one thing is kind of looked at from different perspectives throughout the episode. Particularly, and I don't know whether this is a threat discussion or a theory discussion, I feel like the idea of Ovaz saying, "So no God," and Burnham saying, "No, these two things can happen in parallel."
No. God.
No, comma God. I feel like the Culber's crisis of faith doesn't quite meet up to that completely, and that perhaps that's because we're going on it, you know, we're going to carry it on next episode, versus like Ovaz and Rava are probably we're never ever going to see again. But it's a good discussion to have, and we go from doubt to that of the dust on this dusty world.
Yeah, and just another note there about the previous thread of doubt, you know, the overwritten version of this story is that Culber and Ovaz have a moment there about it, and that they bypass that temptation, right? Temptation being a part of the mother Compeer's journey. The best scenes sometimes are to not write that scene. But with the dust there, right, the whole world, with the exception of this green patch just so layered in it, it's such a nuisance to these people, this poor elderly woman, Honora, and how she's physically struggling with it, and then that they integrate it into this challenge. So it's such a part of their society, of the way they live, and the reminder of what the mother's journey was like.
Yeah, it all works across the themes there. It does have one wonder, you know, essentially, in order to combat the dehydration of this planet, is the High Summit essentially just a giant moisture evaporator? If so, does that make them all moisture farmers? If so, is this possibly, you know, Tatooine thousands or millions of years after the events of Star Wars, and has the grand conjunction occurred? Well, no, because Star Wars is a long time ago. So this is.
I'm sorry. No. Yeah, I gotcha.
Regardless, it's a very palpable threat here. I mean, we've all had moments of thirst. Hopefully most of us have not known true kind of medical dehydration, but we've all been in that ballpark.
How good did they make the water in the wooden bowls look, though? Like the close-ups, like, and it wasn't even a super arid like setting. Like, they're in the woods of Toronto, right? There's foliage, there's shade, but by using the sun through the gaps in the trees, and then the makeup job that they did on the actors to really buy, like, all right, they ate a dust cube and they're hacking it up here. Like, yeah, I drank a lot of water during this episode.
Yeah, and I'll just mention, I think that, yes, they're clearly filming in the forest land outside Toronto or whatnot, but what I assume using computers nowadays is probably a pretty simple thing of saying, hey, computer, the normal green of the trees, now, like, turn it all this kind of alien, you know, teal. Yeah. Like, that was effective, too. We don't need this setting, for a variety of reasons, we don't need this setting to be, you know, what did they used to call it on Next Generation? Like, the planet hell setting, and we don't need to have all sorts of weird colors. Like, it's the alien woods. We got it. It needs to be woods, not desert, because the evaporator does indeed work and so forth. We don't need to overly think this, but you run a quick filter and say, everything that's forest green, turn, you know, teal green, bing, bang, boom. All right, I got it. We're on an alien world.
dad is also a threat on this list, Matt, in the way that he denies that Burnham could be a woman of science, that, you know, he doesn't want to have his culture undermined here, that he must be being tempted rather than, you know, Burnham coming from the stars.
Yeah, if, I mean, look, there's a clear Star Trek lesson here, which should not be ruffling Star Trek fans, which is believe in science, believe in evidence, believe in technology, believe that all these things can be used for our improvement, believe that they can exist, all these things can exist alongside of your faith or alongside of, what I'll say for lack of a better word, kind of the true fantastic nature of the universe, i.e. a God-driven one. You know, these mere observations of science, these meager observations can also be true. All of this is completely in line with Star Trek. And it did make me think back to, you know, coming out of the first season where there was an Entertainment Weekly article. Maybe it was Jason Isaacs. Somebody had ad-libbed the line like, oh, God. And it was like, oh, cut. No, you can't say God because there's no God in the future. And so on and so forth. And I felt like this was a little bit more of a, of Star Trek speaking to us to say, your views can be parallel with the science and evidence that's out there.
And that's where the threat of devotion, like, can you overdo that to not open yourself up to the scientific? I mean, geez, Matt, I wonder where they drew inspiration for this parable over the last couple years.
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, if the criticism towards a good chunk of Discovery is, it turns out, you know, after all these seasons, it turns out that we viewers actually best like largely self-contained episodes that deal with some sort of crazy journey. By the end of it, you kind of reset. Maybe you end up with a flute or a girlfriend, or you broke up with your boyfriend or things of that sort. But we kind of want that more episodic. They gave that to us here, but they also gave us a discussion that's not overly overly of the 2020s about, you know, being in too deep with devotion versus the changing reality of the world, but we got that flavor here, and it's a welcome lesson nonetheless. Pete, let's set our long-range sensors to scan for some theories. Let me kind of tackle it here now that we're in theories. I feel like it's as though Culber does not want to say the word God in an episode where his story mirror, that of Ovaz, is invoking God. And again, maybe Culber will explore this further in future episodes, but I feel like we didn't have parity here, and I'm not quite sure why.
Well, I appreciate the idea here. Oh, I feel more connected. And I can't quite put my finger on it. Okay, let me talk to Hollow Grandma. Yeah, she should be able to answer this, but she gives the inspiration. Get your body checked out. Your body's okay. Okay, so this is something going on with the concept of the soul, right? And Star Trek has done a little bit about that in nearly 60 years. So I think we leave it to the ongoing story here. There is more coming with this character.
I appreciated the notion that this week the clue was the most boring of things, just basic water. And through that, we built a story where it kind of took it took our character's deductive logic, but also in a way that we, the audience, could follow. It wasn't kind of overly scientific. I appreciate that we really are playing with these variations on the theme of you get an Indiana Jones clue each week, and this week the clue worked differently. I hope that for whatever is left of this, you know, we have four episodes to go, do we keep I mean, or actually, Pete, can you give me an update? How many pieces do we have in the thing, and what's our total? What's our fraction here?
So they had 3 in the credit sequence this week, and now we've added to it. So new credits next week, and there's one more piece to find. This was the penultimate piece this week.
So whether that occurs next week or next week is Mollenlock, I won't quite say side quest, but that sort of thing. I feel like I have a sense of how these next 4 episodes are going to go in terms of the one more piece, let's say in the next 2 weeks, the opening of the space vault, for lack of a better image, in the next 2 or 3 weeks, and then the battle over it, what to do with it, and so forth. I can feel the sands going through the hourglass. I don't want this show to end, but I feel like the pace has been good through these episodes.
Yeah, I mean, we cross firmly over the halfway mark this week, and it is sad knowing it's coming to an end, but they're telling the story that they had planned and said they wouldn't change, now knowing how it ends and given the big things they're wrestling with, right? Like, yeah, maybe we'll finally find out, Matt, what God needs with a starship.
It'll be interesting too. Like, I feel, not to necessarily jump to the end of the final episode, but it'll be interesting. Like, I feel like we're on here in this episode. I will assume all of these scenes are from the episodes that we've seen, that we have yet to see any kind of new footage shot, you know, after the cancellation of the series. Book saying, "I wish I could get back together with Burnham." Okay, I can feel that momentum there. That's something that if they had not planned to wrap it up this season, but rather the next season, nonetheless, they can, you know, perhaps that is something, you know, put together for the end. So the end marches ever closer to us, Pete.
I mean, we can look at the last couple of titles, Matt, and I have some ideas there. Maybe we'll save that. Did you catch the first name of the Doctor from Beta Z?
Ooh, I did not. No.
Marina.
Oh.
Dr. Marina Derricks.
I don't know how I didn't catch that one, but Pete, do you want to go so far as to prognosticate a casting decision based on this 800-year-old character, or is it just a nod to our favorite?
Only because we know prior to coming back to Star Trek, Marina Surtees had some things to say about CBS All Access.
Nonetheless, a little tip of the hat there, appreciated. I have to admit, when they were revealing this bit here, I said, "Oh, we're going to Betazoid." No, it's the Beta Z tag from a Beta Z scientist and so forth. So it's frustrating in a good way that every episode ends with, "And we need to work on the clue, so we'll see you next week as we finish working on it." Like, I see what you're doing there, and it's working.
If only they could somehow rig exploring Betazoid culture, particularly their marriage practices, Matt, with Saru and Tarina's possible nuptials.
Yeah, another episode without Doug Jones. Like, choices were made. I don't know whether it's his end, story end, whatever, but choices are made here. Yes, I hope that we do not return to Saru a month into his marriage. Give us the Star Trek wedding. And as you're saying, Pete, if it's a Betazoid wedding, or there's some Betazoid influences, then we could be testing the limits of what's okay on a streamer and Star Trek.
How about this notion, Matt, that trouble at Starfleet Academy that could only be solved possibly by Tilly and Burnham and a show?
Yeah, I would be a favor. I would be a fan, rather. I'd be in favor of special guest star Sonequa Martin-Green appearing in X number of episodes of the Academy show. I feel like we've been on a wonderful journey with Tilly across these 5 seasons, and I would be okay if the Tilly character is not the principal Belding of the Academy show. If that's the direction they want to go, so be it. I'll be there for the show. But I think that if you're going to do this brand new thing and you want to have, you know, special guest stars drop on by, that's fine. But let me put this way, Pete. I feel like is the show setting up the possibility of Tilly being in the Academy show? It is. Am I in favor of that as a real world momentum? No, I am not.
The very notion that there are kids struggling at school and that Tilly doesn't know what to do. I mean, let's remember how she wound up there, right? She was struggling coming forward to the 32nd century. Oh, goes on this mission to the ice planet with the cadets. Oh, maybe I've found myself as a teacher. And now the evolution of that, helping these kids to find the answers they need. It feels to me, and this is just me, that Starfleet Academy is the soft cancellation of Discovery, if you will, that we're staying in the era that through Tilly, Burnham, anybody who's popped up on this show is now a guest shot away, right? It's effectively Deep Space Nine and Voyager, right? Which was not going to be the case Discovery to Picard, different eras, which is not proven the case yet with Strange New Worlds, other than the characters that had come through Discovery, right? With Pike and Spock and Una. But, you know, ultimately could, if they wanted to bring Tyler back in for a Section 31 mission, or, you know, we had the great Klingon, you know, Chancellor Laurel. All right. But I think it makes a lot of sense. Like, the thing I've been thinking a lot about lately when it comes to Starfleet Academy and, you know, this whole big thing about the gigantic set they've built, like, you can't spend all the time at the Starfleet Academy on the Starfleet Academy show, right? Like, all right, you'll do holograms, like, all right, now we're going to go on the Kobayashi Maru. But they're going to need to go places on missions. And a way to do that beyond just the guest star factor is, oh, hey, adjunct professor Captain Burnham is here, and we got to do something with the blah, blah, blahs this week.
Yes, but Deep Space Nine, you know, like, and I know, look, obviously, as Deep Space Nine went on, they, you know, moved away from the runabouts, got their own starship, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I think that, you know, circa, when did Deep Space Nine start? 92? Like, you know, late 80s, early 90s, when it was like, let's do a second show, and it needs to differentiate. I think that perhaps a selling point was, oh my goodness, we've been to the planet Hell stage how many times? How many different colors of orange can we paint the sky? How many different alien shrubs can we spray paint, you know, yellow? Like, what if people stayed in town? What if people stayed in Space Town? What if it was an old West town where everybody comes to the, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that to a certain degree for Deep Space Nine, it was baked in. Like, we have these the then biggest ever Star Trek set. We can do all this stuff. We're going to intentionally, you know, build up to a recurring, you know, cast of 25, 35 people. So, you know, it doesn't need to be a bottle episode to say, this week, our favorite, you know, whatever, thief comes back to town and we got things of that sort, right? So I wonder, I mean, and I'm not disagreeing, Pete, that it's a Star Trek show that should trek in the stars, but maybe as part of it, you know, baked in, like, hey, we can do the episode that's entirely on campus. And again, not because it's a lockdown, not because it's Picard on a ship with most of the lights turned out while people try and break into it, that build this giant set and then just stay put more often versus each week beaming down to a new spot or a new green screen rig with wire work and things of that sort. You know, it'll be interesting. I'll say when we see this show, I want to have the little asterisk or the voice in the back of my head saying, assuming it doesn't get canceled, before it's even made or turned into a 2-hour pilot movie that's just a movie, etc. It could be that they're looking to do less trekking in the stars, at least in the early years of this show.
Well, what Kurtzman talks about on the Ready Room this week is how he only wants to do more if it's different. And, all right, they're going to do I know they've used YA, but I don't mean to denigrate that as a description, but I think it aims to be a little bit more than that when it comes to the Starfleet Academy series. Shifting thoughts here, though, Matt, Burnham and Book, will there be a reunion?
I mean, I think that there will have to be between now and the end of the series. And if part of that was what was, you know, what was shot in the day and a half or 2 days of filming after the series's cancellation, then so be it. I mean, it's just a logical, they were together, now they're apart. Now in this episode, we're seeing Book say, what if, it's just a logical place to end the series, particularly since there has been this opportunity to go back and end the way you want to end in a post-cancellation scenario. Perhaps it'll come sooner and we'll say, oh, look, they were planning on this even before before things truly ended.
So, Matt, a question of procedure. Do Mother Compeer Journeyers have to tell everyone else they're doing that?
Oh, listen, absolutely. I think that when you are a Mother Compeer, journeyer, you're all about that lifestyle. You're all about the right footwear. You're looking for the proper bark from the tree to give you added bounce in your arch. Probably if not for the
they
last minute.
One dust chip challenges on their own to see how long they can go and then tell everybody what their record is and, you know, how little water they've had.
Oh, 100%. You go to your local, your village's seamsman, and you say, listen, can you make me a shirt that says, I did 23.6 hours without water and all that sort. And you kind of put it on the back of your satchel and so forth. It's part of who they are, Pete. It's part of who they are.
Lastly, I will say, as for the next episode, just a warning for anybody, if they don't watch the Ready Room, if you don't want to have a cameo spoiled next week, maybe avoid that.
Well, Pete, I don't watch the Ready Room, so I know there's something to not have spoiled for me. Pete, I better watch this next episode ASAP and not dilly-dally. Good info for us all. And with that, let's open Hailing Frequencies.
Hailing Frequencies open, sir.
Pete, before we even get to Twitter, let's start with how would you describe it? This most unique email that we received? How would you like to tee this
up? A bombshell is what I would describe it as. I remember seeing this and texting you like, have you seen this yet? All right. And just going through this and now being able to share it with our listeners. Just wow.
And Pete, let me preface this to our listeners by saying it, we are reading this email. We were not asked to keep the email private. It is signed by a nom de plur. Pete, should I dive into the email here?
Do it.
So, hey guys, I'm writing you after I came across your podcast this week and thought you might be interested in my perspective. I actually work in NYC doing PR for Paramount Global. I was recently pulled off other projects and on to doing some of the work for the Star Trek account. This week, we did a screening in DC with Sinequa. It was a big deal and a lot of hours in the making. The PR heads, however, were very upset now because no one was talking about it online. It was as if it never even happened. The word disaster comes to mind. The search for reactions on social media is what had me find your podcast and listen to a couple episodes. They provided me with the soundtrack to the hellacious email thread I was CC'd on this week. In the aftermath, and it was really bad because some of the PR higher-ups started with the Star Trek account in 2016, 2017, they want to cast a bigger net, but they can't seem to generate the interest in the product when there's a podcast like yours just sitting out there doing fine work unconnected to the company. I noticed you guys don't call yourselves the Star Trek Discovery podcast. Why is that anyway? The irony is that Paramount Plus is looking to find ways to get the word out, but they have canceled Discovery. Also, word on the street is that if, big if, the sale happens to Skydance Media, the Star Trek brand is in huge trouble. Apparently, David Ellison isn't familiar with the shows, and his father is very opposed to certain aspects of what Star Trek has become. You guys seem very professional and need to know that the people attempting to promote this product, which I agree with you is pretty good, are largely incompetent. Not everyone at Paramount PR may be a fan. It is work after all. But it's completely apparent that the quality buzz you bring to our product that our team is ill-equipped or unable to build. As Discovery ends in a couple weeks, the future of Star Trek may actually depend on the approach they take to give it a big finish. Pete, that signed... Well, I won't say quite anonymously, but it's signed by someone going by the name Alpha Cat.
I mean, there's so much to be gleaned from this email. And first and foremost, thank you, Alpha Cat, for reaching out. Like, this could have just been something that remained unknown. I was aware they had a screening of this episode Monday, the 29th. In Washington, D.C., there was like a Google form that had been posted on one of the Star Trek socials, and I didn't even bring it to Matt's attention. Like, all right, we're not going to drive to D.C. to be a part of this, not getting a huge lead time or anything like that. But looking into it, when that was mentioned, like, there was no follow-up to this. I saw one tweet about this, it having happened. So no wonder Alpha Cat is pointing out here, they got no bounce off this. Why would you even do it? And the aspect here, it's like it didn't happen. But a lot of this seems super familiar, Matt, with what we go back. Alpha Cat asks, why don't we call ourselves the Star Trek Discovery Podcast? And then you consider that the timeline laid out by some of the PR people when we were told we could not.
Yeah, and going back to this DC screening, I know when you had brought it to my attention and I did a little search, it was... I think it was a little bit later in the life cycle of its anticipation. And what I was seeing was like, oh, it's first come, first served. Or like, they didn't say while supplies last, but there was words, you know, while tickets are available or something like that. And I was looking at it going, well, can you imagine? Let's say one lives in the DC area and you go, okay, cool. This spot is a metro ride away.
Same as everywhere else, man.
Yeah. But to sit and go, oh, well, if I show up 2 hours ahead of time, all the tickets might be gone. Like, even that in of itself is somewhat deflating. Like, run it. You know, when we had the great privilege of being able to get into the Strange New Worlds gold carpet world premiere, like, that was a ticketed event. And we had our, you know, you were under your name with your plus one. And we walked up and gave your name and ditto for me. You know, the whole nine yards. Like,
plus one back. There were three of us total. Like, and that was important because therein, somebody else got a spot.
Yeah. And in fact, I remember when I emailed that to there was a third party company running it, like, spelling out very clearly, like, still me, still just me, keep my name, but I want to give the plus one back. It was like, oh, thank you so much. Like, it was as short as that, but it was like, it wasn't just message received. It was like my enthusiasm, their enthusiasm, bing, bang, boom. So it's strange times on top of strange times. It's strange times, Pete.
But hear the corporate stuff through the eyes of somebody working PR at the company. Okay. And that Ellison and the dad and what they might mean to Star Trek and all of that. And all right, yeah, there are always going to be people that call their bosses incompetent, but that this person found us and realizes what we do, and we're not paid by Paramount. And I don't know whether they've made the suggestion. If I could follow up with Alpha Cat, that's what I would. Like, well, hey, we're right here. You want to tell your people to bring us in, and you know, we're going to keep it Fantastic Geek, and we're going to shoot it down the middle. You know, we're not going to get the pom-poms out, nor are we going to bash it and be just a voice of negativity like so much that's online. But yeah, you know, our hollow DMs remain open.
Pete, to Twitter we go for listeners' ratings of this episode. Going from the bottom up, how many people gave it the ensign rank? That's 0%. A lieutenant, 9.1%. The commander rank, 22.7%. And then the captain's rank, 68.2%. Some replies here on Twitter. First from JT Adkins, at JTA is me. This season is all about finding clues. Everyone knows that the OG clue finder is a guy named Steve. Pete, the Blues Clues. He even had a Starfleet uniform. Get that handy-dandy notebook out, Steve. There's even a blue on board, BLU. Hashtag Star Trek Discovery, and also sharing a picture of the Steve actor, dressed a bit later in life, but dressed in his Captain Picard uniform. Next tweet here, James is sagacious, big killing on Twitter. Not a super action-packed thriller, moves the story along. Michael and Tilly running felt nostalgic. It all feels like a sad goodbye. Next tweet, Andre Yeager at Dr. Polo 1983. It wouldn't be a classic Star Trek season if they didn't break the Prime Directive at some point. Well said, Andre. Nice episode. I'm liking the whole treasure hunt thing. Makes the time fly and gives them a clear goal each episode. Next, we hear from It's Twitter Not Life at KCLYLE1. Some really mixed feelings here. Love having Tilly back and so involved in the story, and eye scanners are way cool. But something about the dialogue in parts felt off, or maybe it was the line delivery. Off is the best way I can describe it. Other parts were fine and some even good. Kind of surprised they even care about the Prime Directive so far in the future. The story was pretty interesting, putting a few more obstacles in the way of clues. Overall, a decent episode, but nothing outstanding. But they all can't be great, can they? And last tweet, Pete, comes from Spider-Ham Lincoln, Tess LC139. I've seen some gushing reviews of this episode already, but I don't share in the gushiness. If filler wasn't such an anathema term, I'd call whistle-speak that. For me, the best parts involved Culber and Adira. Otherwise, it was fair to middling, with still no Owo and Detmer. It's Twitter Not Life replied, agreed, not awful, nothing special. Would I take more seasons of Discovery? I would. And Spider-Ham Lincoln says, of course, me too. Pete, what do you have there on Facebook?
Jeff Beaton writes into the Fantastic Geek Facebook page. Thank you for reading the notes. I like Matt's suggestion that the models on the Enterprise D were all UFP, named after the aircraft carrier. I like it. Thanks. Disco 506, there were some things early on that bothered me, but the fact that they went to the wrong tower makes me feel like it was worth it. Solid Star Trek. Tricorder I seems a little psi-quarter-ish. but hey, it's really, really far into the future. You guys get better news than I, but The Economist printed this today. The chances of a takeover of Paramount Global by Skydance, a production company, looked slim after Paramount, owner of the Hollywood studio of the same name, CBS, Nickelodeon, and more, reportedly decided not to extend exclusive negotiations beyond midnight on Friday. Sony Pictures and Apollo, a private equity firm, this week made a rival $26 billion offer for Paramount, which is controlled by Shari Redstone, who seems ready to sell.
Pete, I will just return to the metaphor that we've used in the past, which is imagine, well, we'll modify it slightly. Pete, imagine you and your brothers owned an orchard and it's been going along and there's been ups and downs in the business and so forth. And imagine that you and your brothers had the good fortune to extend to me a portion of the ownership, meaning I would have 1/5 of it, you, one of four brothers. That doesn't change the fact that I might say, guys, let's start growing oranges. And you guys can say, well, no, actually, you can come up with all the suggestions you want, Matt. This is still the brothers running the show. That's the case with Paramount. Yes, there's many stockholders, but Shari Redstone is the one that owns the majority of the voting stock. It's not quite a mathematical thing, as neat as I've given it. So there's the me's out there saying, I have a good idea. How about Skydance? I have a good idea. How about Sony? If the one, literally the one person, Shari Redstone, doesn't like the idea, then it doesn't happen, which is certainly frustrating if you're a Class B stock holder of Paramount, which is to say you have very little voting power, and this lady is in charge of the entire direction of the company.
Yeah, and we're spending so much time talking about this on a Star Trek podcast just, again, indicates what a problem it is. Matt Robert T. Frost writes in, hello, Matt and Pete. I've been enjoying season 5 of Discovery, but enjoying the Fantastic Geek podcast about Discovery more. Over the last several podcasts, you have been pointing out when the show redresses a set, whether it's for ease of filming or economics. I think we saw the ultimate set redress when the Discovery's shuttlecraft went through the pulsating aperture into the pocket universe. It sure looked like they gussied up the aperture opening from Star Trek, the motion picture, where it says Spoke, but I'm sure he means Spock, flies into V'ger. Just imagine the cost savings. How responsible of the showrunners to pull that out of storage and not build a whole new set? Question mark, exclamation point, crying emoji. As for Commander Rayner's boiled cake, an English pudding? Maybe more in common than we think. Until next time, your friend, Bob.
I was holding in the laughter so as not to ruin the recording / podcast, but well said there, Bob. Look, it's all Star Trek ideas may be good ideas. I'm thinking of, you know, the motion picture bridge, which the physical walls of that set that made its way to Voyager. I mean, it was the Battle Bridge in the Enterprise D. It was every single. It was the science lab in the Enterprise D. You know, so just yeah. It's an old tradition to be reusing Star Trek stuff. So it's all good, I suppose.
Had some tweets too, Matt. I just wanted to point out, though they were to last week's poll. Brett Desmo Williams had written in about the Georgiou mirror time stuff, and a reminder here that Georgiou had to go back in time because the universes are drifting apart in ISS Enterprise time. They could live comfortably in each other's worlds. Karen Chu followed that up, came here to mention Kovich said about 500 years ago the universes started drifting apart, which is what is causing her issue. The period where Dr. Cho would have been active was 24th century, well before the drift. I'll have to check on that span, but I'm certain it was like 500. And they're both right, and this is why I should have gone back and checked. So Brett and Karen, thank you for writing in and keep me honest.
Great catches there, and bringing it back to Discovery 506 here via the email inbox. Dustin, who had sent us the Wall Street Journal article that we referenced at the beginning, says of this episode, guys, thanks as always. I thought 506 was great. I felt like I was watching a 2024 version of a mid-season episode of TNG. I think it was a well-done nod to the show's format. The race was a mix of hilarious, Tilly's mid-race peace sign with a little hop, and terrifying, the salt sand cubes and temptation of fresh water. I guess when I first saw the cubes, I thought we were about to watch our heroes go on a hallucinogenic journey. The pre-race stretching by the participants was corny but funny. Overall, the A-plot worked well. What hit hardest for me, though, was Culber's spiritual awakening journey. What a ride. Really elevated dialogue for all his scenes and just a beautiful story. I'm finding the aphorisms from Book, Culber's grandmother, and the others to be really powerful. I'm able to basically experience the lessons along with Culber through the tremendous performances of Wilson Cruz and others. Finally, other than for the Tour de France in July each year, I've never woken up early just to watch a show until this season of Discovery. I'm hoping my 5:30 a.m. start time is registered as an uncanny vote of support for the Star Trek universe, for whatever suitor ends up with the Star Trek property when this mess at Paramount is finally resolved. Pete, that from Dustin Bradford.
Much in the same way, it's really unnatural that fans would be on a first name basis with Kathleen Kennedy, right? The way this outrage culture is constantly, how did you see? She's ruined Star Wars again. Star Trek fans should not be talking about, they should not know as much about the behind the scenes intrigue of the sale of this company that they do. Like, this is unnatural. We just want to enjoy our Star Trek, man. We just want it to be there without the fear that it's going to go away. There'll be less of it, that as you point out with your tongue firmly planted in cheek every time, like, oh, look, they save money. Like, because you're imitating what they did in a lot of these behind the scene deals. I want it to be over. I want us to firmly understand what is the future of Star Trek.
I would like the pressure taken off of Star Trek. I mean, and this is something I said a couple of podcasts ago. Voyager launched a network. Mm-hmm. Star Trek Enterprise was created at a point where it was clear that UPN was not going to last. So that kind of went through the beginning of the drawdown of that network, but still, like, let's land this ship here. Let's also not forget, Enterprise was canceled after 3 seasons, then came back for the 4th with like a 40% budget reduction. Ditto for Discovery in this whole era. And, you know, it's in the last month with some of these financial discussions where it's like 1 out of 5 Paramount Plus subscribers watch one of the Star Trek shows, or they're there for Star Trek. I would love the pressure to be off. I would love for a Peacock or a Disney Plus or a Netflix or Prime or whomever to be like, oh, we spend $100 million a year on Star Trek. That is value added because we can see that when you're not watching, you know, I don't know, pick your streamer. When you're not watching this show and that show and the other, this type of customer is also there for Star Trek. Cool. Or this Star Trek customer also watches the other Ron Moore show on Apple TV Plus, or the sci-fi show where they're all in a silo or something. Like, something where it's not like, hey, we need to keep Star Trek going because otherwise this $1 billion a year money losing thing called Paramount Plus, like all of these businesses that started, you know, in the red, Star Trek needs to keep it propped up. Like, how about just Star Trek is a value added thing to a thing that already works?
We talk all the time how they've produced some of their best work when they're in crisis. So I'm fully confident, Matt, that as Discovery ends here, we're going to be looking back and saying, boy, they really nailed it at the end. Can't wait to see what they've got for Section 31 and then the end as well of Lower Decks.
Pete, still back to the email inbox. Can I point out, by the way, Pete, parenthetically, that prior to this episode, we've been getting less emails, which, you know, it's the later seasons of a show and so forth. The email inbox has come roaring back this week. This email from Jackie Wolf, who says, "Hi, Matt and Pete, just a few notes on the latest episode of Star Trek Discovery. I was glad to see Dr. Culber practice medicine in a more concrete way this episode. As much as I appreciate the emphasis on mental health, I want to see him do more than just ask people how they're doing. As disappointed as I was to not get to see Denoblia, the planet that we did see was really cool. Their makeup was very reminiscent of some TNG alien races with drawn-on markings in lieu of prosthetics. perhaps, Pete, you want to finish your sentence here, perhaps as a money-saving tactic. I wasn't initially sure that he could be trusted, but I like the direction of Commander Raynor's character. His command style reminds me of Captain Jellicoe, if you'll permit me another TNG reference. I feel that if we had seen Jellicoe for more than two episodes, he would have had a similar character arc as Raynor seems to be having. As we start to understand Raynor's command style and he starts to mesh with the crew, it makes me even more sad that Discovery is coming to an end. Thanks for flying along with us, Fantastic Geek. And Jackie Wolf says, P.S. I'd like to recommend that listeners look up the whistle languages of places like La Gomera in the Canary Islands. Fascinating stuff. So, Pete, let's all head to Wikipedia when the party is over.
Just another reason why this fan base is so knowledgeable and needs the firmness of a Star Trek situation figured out.
Pete, last email, at least last email that was a text email, comes from Josephine Avalos, who says, "May the fourth be with you. Oh, my bad, wrong star show. I missed out in the last couple weeks of episode feedback. For Face the Strange, it was cool having Michael and Raynor jump through time, and only Stamets was immune to the time changes. Reminds me of TNG's final season when Picard was going through time, and the only person who understood him was Guinan. For Mirrors, I think the episode is going to have something to do with the Section 31 movie. That wormhole is probably going to show up in another Star Trek. Booker's ship is still stuck in it. This final season, we get a lot of Culber. No complaints here. He's handsome. But I was so happy to see his abuela. I'm not sure if I could ever move on from death, if I could create a hologram of them to still speak to and seek advice from as a form of therapy. Honestly, that's not too far from our future with the advancements of AI-generated characters. I'm glad they're finally addressing Culber's character. I mean, this guy for real died and rematerialized like he never left from inside another animal. Now he's just had a couple thousand-year-old spirit take over his body. Of course he's going to feel weird. Stamets' reaction to Culber's mental concern was dismissive, but he's always been like that. I think throughout Star Trek, there's always a thin line between what's science and what's spiritual. This episode was surrounded with spiritual dilemmas. OMG, remember that Voyager episode when they were stuck in orbit of a planet that rotated really fast and their ship was worshipped by the settlers that evolved for centuries? I had to tell them then that they weren't gods. They were just some folks in fancy uniforms stuck in orbit. Okay, I'm getting sidetracked. Basically, I'm glad Culber is going through a spiritual awakening, but poor Ovaz and his people, they have to rethink if their gods exist. Cue the rain. That dude straight slammed the stone door. Tilly's face when she heard him say sacrifice. There was too much downtime, in my opinion. We got Booker playing old school arcade games. I think the only stressed out character that remained on the ship was Adira having to walk Michael through the control panel. I miss seeing Detmer and Awoshikan on the bridge. In the beginning, I thought the Borg was together and do reshoots. Well, that's all I got. I'll leave with how Tilly would have described this episode and just gives up. You can take the Xeno out of the anthropologist, but you can't take the Anthro. I lost it. Semper Fi, that from Josephina.
Thank you, Josephina. I really like the hologram grief, you know, interaction with the loved one. Like, yeah, and with AI, that could completely work. But again, that Star Trek fans know the potential folly in the technology. Like, people might never move past the loss of a relative and instead become consumed with the holographic representation.
Well, with that, Pete, let's now go to Admiral Fred of the Netherlands.
Hello, Matt and Pete and all listeners to Fantastic Geek. This is Fred from the Netherlands with a little feedback for Star Trek Discovery Season 5, Episode 6. And that little feedback will be very little feedback. I didn't like this episode too much, so I don't want to be too negative. It was quite episodic. It looked a little bit like a Next Generation episode with going to a world with pre-warp technology, respecting the Prime Directive, and then finally violating it. I found the story not so appealing and a bit slow-paced and predictable. And also Michael Burnham's whispering, or Sinequa Mortar Green's whispering, is back, which doesn't make it much better for me. So here I stop, otherwise it gets too negative. Sorry guys, can't make it better. Hopefully the next few episodes will be better. Greetings, all the best, Fred from the Netherlands.
Pete, I have to confess, when I got done watching this episode the first time through, I think I was more Camp Fred than perhaps this podcast has shown. And it's an interesting criticism to say it's just a TNG, it's like a TNG episode where they go to a pre-warp civilization and solve everything by the end. I think that's a plus to the negative. I think that's also a negative to the episode. But certainly I send my thanks to Fred for sharing his honest thoughts there.
Well, I mean, it was whistle speak though, and not whisper speak.
Well said there, Pete. Starting to wrap things up on a funny there. But Pete, before we officially start to wrap up, the time has come to announce the next winner of our Discovery t-shirt. This from the list of our Patreon supporters. Any razzle-dazzle you want to give, Pete, before I spin the electronic wheel before me?
No, spin away.
All right. The winner is Gunnar JCH. I know we've had some good Star Trek discussions with Gunnar JCH in the journey here, so I'll be reaching out. Congrats, Gunnar GCH.
And just a reminder, one more week to enter yourself into a drawing for either a Falcon and the Winter Soldier, Moon Knight, Obi-Wan Kenobi, or Andor, either 4K Blu-ray or traditional Blu-ray. You'll get the choice. There will only be one winner, and the way to enter that drawing, like the half dozen names that we already have in the hopper, is to upgrade your, actually we have seven now, Matt, is to upgrade your Patreon contribution, or to join us as a patron for the first time. But right now you're looking at at least the 1 in 7 shot if you've put your name through for that.
And thanks as always to those who support us on patreon.com/fantasticgeek. Pete, can't wait to continue the discussion here. We got Star Trek in the near future, and then Star Wars returning in June with the Acolyte series. So how can people be in touch with you on social media to talk about those properties?
You can find me on Twitter, on Threads, on Blue Sky, at Peter, PieterJKetelaar, KetelaaR, 12,600 followers, can't be wrong.
And while I'm personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast, comment on fantasticgeek.com, check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, and Threads. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/fantasticgeek with the P and the H, like it today.
Pete, back this time next week on Star Trek Sunday to discuss the next episode of Star Trek Discovery. Looking forward in the near future to bringing back Star Wars Saturdays as we get closer and closer to the Acolyte series. For now, though, I will say adios to all listeners and give you, Pete, the final word.
You ever get tired of having all the answers?
We'll be right back.